You're listening to The Good.
Don't call me Paino.
The Bad.
Absolute.
And The Rugby.
Folded like a deck chair.
With Paino, Lord, and The Hask. I don't know what that means.
Hello, Dream Team, and a very warm welcome to yet another episode of The Good, The Bad, and The Rugby in partnership with City Index, the leading provider of spread betting, CFD, and FX trading. Hask and Tins are in the building.
How are we?
Looking ever more like the Mitchell brothers, I might say.
What?
We were both wearing white.
You were trying to cover the lid then.
Yeah, I was.
Yeah, but I've got a bit more albino. It's not going any thinner. I don't think it's any worse. It's just a tan is pretty good. I'm not lying to you.
Well, okay. That's why you've gone white, isn't it?
We want to let you in on a little secret, which is we're actually recording this in July. Obviously, it's going out a little bit later than that. And that's because this is the only time we could get our guest in London, in the studio, and we did not want to miss the opportunity to speak to him because this is a pod with a difference today. We're going to talk about a lot more than rugby. In fact, we always like talking about almost anything but rugby. But we are honoured to be joined by a man who once played in the Championship for Rotherham and Esher, the glamour clubs. And has since jacked it all in for a career in journalism, most recently working for BBC News as one of their Ukraine correspondents. James Waterhouse, how are you?
Very well, thank you, Alex.
Hopefully better at your job than I am at mine. Not difficult in that regard. Where to start in really, I mean, as CVs go, that's got a lot happening at both ends of it.
It does, but as Hask alluded to there, I don't think anyone really wants to hear about National One in 2008.
You say that.
It did set the world alight. But yeah, it's an unusual path. I sort of played until 25, was desperate to like play at the top, make it in the Premiership. But a combination of lack of talent and just not being willing to make the sacrifices. Yeah.
So I plateaued at 25. This is lack of talent, but making the sacrifices.
Yeah, no, that's not. That's
quite for Greece, James.
Absolutely not.
Did you not see my name above the door?
I'm very much a Putin-style operation here. Yeah. Anyone who doesn't agree gets fucking liquidated.
They're listening.
I think they will be listening. Actually, I'm a little bit concerned about doing that. When I saw your name come up, I was like, I do not need the Russians hacking into any of my stuff.
They've got enough on.
They can join the list. There's a few others trying to get into
Most of the people I upset haven't got the competency to do their shoelaces up.
If they hacked into your stuff, the Kremlin explodes.
Imagine that. It's like the sheer volume of porn. I don't understand. How's it got enough hours in the day? You must have worn it down to a nub. Wait, Putin just sends me a pot of pseudocrem and a card. Well, I'm really sorry for doing this.
We're really excited to have a highbrow conversation.
News thing. James Waterhouse has done what?
You know, when he came in straight away, he was like, yes, I know. We'll talk a bit about Ukrainian Championship rugby. He's like, yeah, probably none, mate. Making friends influence.
It's not Ukrainian Championship rugby. It's Championship rugby. And now
Ukraine.
My first question was going to be, because there's going to be people out there who are probably in similar shoes to you where they want to make it. Did someone have a conversation with you, or was it a self-realization that, look, this is going to be a slog for not much money that could lead nowhere? And you,
I think it's a good question. So it was a combination. Rugby compared to football, if you play the second tier, it's not like playing football in the Championship. You don't make any money. You know, I was making, I think, 12 grand a year doing part-time at Esher and doing a sales job out of a porter cabin, selling rugby and cricket kit to schools and bothering PE teachers that didn't want to be bothered. And so for me, I was reaching that juncture where I also had a year in Plymouth under Graham Dorr.
Did you?
Which, you know, you've got to love rugby.
That puts hairs on the chest.
You know, so...
Was his fingers the wrong...
He's got a little finger that is at 90 degrees.
Yeah. Yeah, but when it's like that, isn't it? Yeah. It's like that.
And it's almost misleading to use the word little.
Because they're giant sausage, aren't they?
For your family for a week.
But the ripping and the tearing on that, like, get that curled into a shirt.
Yeah.
You just take your shirt and your skin off with it.
And your soul.
Yeah. Look right through it.
Yeah. He expects to get that.
Was it gnarly?
Was it horrifically gnarly?
It was. I mean, there's so many examples to give you. Right. So when I joined in 2009, he had played a game at 50 years of age and he'd fractured a bone in his neck playing in the old National One. He was stretchered off, ambulance, all the rest of it. I joined, walked to the rubber crumb pitch in the summer, and Dorsey was doing shuttles on his own. At the time, he'd have been 50, 51. Then crab walking and pushing a tractor tire with his head. He'd crab walk, push a tractor tire, then he'd get on the Concept 2 rower and flog himself. I mean, the guy is just fit as a fiddle. There's nothing on him. You know, old school aerobic fitness, you'd apply it to rugby. And that was my introduction to Graham Dorr. And he would spend a season just starting mind games with individual players. And he'd sort of walk up to them and go, "Have you peaked? What's your drop off?" And players would be like, I don't know, Graham. I don't know. And, you know, I didn't play
Have
that.
You peaked? Did you peak?
Oh, I didn't play very well under him. And right. I didn't
you
really
peaked
get
earlier
then. I peaked at 24. I was like, yeah. Yeah. I could answer him directly. But I came back, finished at Esher, and the love was waning. And I remember vividly, you know, it's a beautiful game. You're in a bubble of training with your mates in the week. There's no substitute for playing at the weekend, but it waned. And I had that natural feeling of there's something more out there, in parallel with my dad saying, get a proper job. I'm not going to bankroll you or you know, subsidize your holidays or whatever.
What I love about this is that we have just been, and you said hello on the way, on the overchange. We've just had George Gregan in here, sort of one of the greats who tells stories of winning Bledisloe Cups and World Cups and Super Rugby. But rugby is, I mean, this is the game. You know, that for every George Gregan, there is a James Waterhouse.
Yeah.
And
thank you, Alex.
Any time you're in a sentence with George Gregan, you just take it.
Yeah. Exactly.
I mean, don't read into the inference that you're on one end of a very, very difficult slide.
I'm as interested in your stories as I am in here. In all seriousness, when you look back at the career, I mean, a lot of people talk about, you know, getting to the level they get to, et cetera. Did you love the rugby you played, or I'm sort of getting the inference that you were a talented rugby player, but never really found the love for it that perhaps others did.
Well, that's probably pretty fair. You know, I was a useful six or eight, you know, and in my early 20s, loved throwing my body about, probably lacked some handling skills, but I just loved, you know,
sounds familiar,
throwing,
this, yeah.
Like threw myself in, had a great time. I think, you know, if it had been the 70s or 80s, I might have played higher. Like I love the amateur side of it.
Yeah.
I loved, you know, the boozing afterwards and you know, the all day is on a Sunday or
that's probably why
I
didn't
else.
Succeed.
I know.
They're not meant to be every weekend. They're meant to be once a season.
I'm already there, James. I'm already there. But, you know, I love that. But I remember it was like the mid-noughties where like the lower leagues tried to be more professional. They tried to mirror the premiership a bit. So all of a sudden, like the likes of Rotherham would have an S&C coach. But I remember being like 19, 20 with a stacked squat rack, not really knowing what was going to happen when I went down, you know, and it was that kind of thing where they'd throw in quite hard, probably not well thought through conditioning on top of what is a brutal league, but then all the social alongside it. So it's just like this kind of cauldron and I don't know, it just kind of waned.
I can see at that level why either you love it and you really commit to it or you look for other things. If you would look back now, would you pick out highlights? What would be the sort of, you had one or two quite big games.
Yeah, so we drew, I love this game. At Esher, we drew with Exeter when they were the Premiership promotion favourites. They just got Sandy Park built. You know, Tony Rose in charge, you know, new investment. And they were running like a Premiership side. They were the dominant force. And it was the year when National One got reorganised into the Championship. So they cut 16 teams to 12.
Yeah.
And they relegated five teams. That year we got relegated. We finished something like 30-odd points above Sedgley Park, but we still went down and we had a 10-game winning streak. And it was one of the best times of my life, playing with your mates. We went there, we drew 12 all, scuppered their chances, Bristol went up. And that feeling of that game and just been like, you know, the underdog status in that arena. I mean, they had all the ball. I think collectively we made more than 150 tackles. But, you know, we clung on.
But there's something about that, especially defensive effort together. I think it'd be interesting when we come onto your career in sort of journalism, having had that background as a player and then watching what people like in corporate world, where they talk about teams, they talk about ethics, but a lot of people never have to play for something bigger than themselves, and actually getting to do something like that in a dig deep, put that many tackles in, look to the man next year, look, we're on to something, we're going to ruin this people's party, and they're the best, must be quite a good lesson as well.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. People don't get angry with me. I'm not going to draw too many parallels with my career and yours. Like, you played at the level you did. I watched, you know, with pleasure the games you played in, and you know, it was intense as I saw it. But there is a lot to be said. You know, we travelled there. We were excited, nervous excitement. Not really sure what was going to happen. You know, and we came from all sorts of backgrounds, and The banter was the same, no holds barred. But yeah, I hold on to that with a lot of fondness.
Is that also the downside? Is you find that band of brothers, you draw with the guys who are potentially going up, you're getting relegated. You've put your body in the well, and then you've probably not got any support off the back of it. You probably don't get really any appreciation for it. I mean, you can only do that so many times before it is going to get waning, because you're going to, why am I still here? Is that something that you think that they've got wrong in terms of championship? Because I know you said it, I think you've said it in the past, that it was supposed to be a vehicle for people to be able to play at the top of their game, but it's not really working that way.
No, and it hasn't for some time. You know, I think you can be more extrinsically motivated at the top. So in the Premiership, you have your loyal followings, you're playing to 15, 20,000 minimum every week. It's a much more of a professional/business model.
Yeah.
Whereas National One and the Championship, and the Championship probably still is, going through this weird identity crisis where at the top end you've got Ealing, who are employing a full-time side, which in my view is not at a standard that justifies, you know, because where is the business model? They are not getting gates of 10,000, really. But I get the chicken and egg argument. You know, do you need to get to that point where you can bring in the gates? But you either are a community club where you have a big societal function where you give something for kids to do, you bring people together to watch a match on a Saturday, or you are a professional outfit, a franchise or whatever, you know, that's a separate debate, but you are laying on something that is, you know, a proper business proposition that benefits the international side and is a goal, a realistic goal for young players wanting to come up. And I just think, you know, I think the UK should be more like New Zealand, where you have an amateur game bridging into, you know, your professional kind of provincial sides.
Obviously, you said that playing Exeter was a highlight, but you also got to play against a Northampton side on the way down, just having a little sojourn in the championship with Bruce Rehana, Chris Ashton, Dylan Hartley,
King Carlos.
I can imagine that was a bit of a shock to the system.
Yeah.
Did you feel the complete difference in ability and in professionalism? But also then you've seen some other sides, like Saracens, gone down and obviously they won, came out of it, but they lost to Ealing. There's a few scalps that have been taken. When I played for Wasp, we lost to Pertemps Bees in the power game thing. Yeah, they were 200, they were 265 to one to beat us.
Yeah. Is that 2002? I think I remember that.
Yeah. I mean, I'd come back from injury and there was a load of, I mean, I think someone made some money out of that. Yeah. I'm not going to lie.
I'm sure one coach was seen going on holiday.
Well, maybe that happened, but I certainly didn't get any tips. But yeah, but what was that like? Was that a real wake-up call or?
Yeah, massive. I think it was, we played Saracens with Esher in a pre-season game in the boiling heat and we lost 96-0.
Ouch.
And I just,
well, to keep it under 100.
I thought we really dug in. But
they were proud of that.
you take all the wins. With that, it was just the speed. Like when we played at Franklin's Gardens or at home, it was just the speed of the game. Like it was, you know, we couldn't put enough heat on the breakdown to slow their ball. So therefore, we were just like tackle bag holders. We may as well have
chasing
had
shadows.
No limbs. Yeah. Yeah, we were just completely nowhere. I think like with the lower leagues, it's a lot more attritional. There's a lot more cheating. You know, the surfaces aren't as good. I think there's a bit of romance to the sport.
Yeah.
You know, like actually you can get dragged down like Pertemps Bees or whatever. You know, there's always that likelihood. But yeah, the step up, I mean, Bruce Rehana was, I just remember being so good. Like he was just powerful, quick, and he'd run hard.
As well. Yeah.
I remember that. I asked the Saris guys what their first game in the championship was like, and he said that they just came around the corner, someone just shoulder charged someone in the head, someone got punched in the face. And it for the lads, you know, they're obviously tough people, but it was almost like a bit of a reset. Oh,
yeah.
And the referee's just like, play on. Yeah. Sorry, what? He's just been punched in the face. We're not going to draw about this, play on.
Yeah.
It was just a bit of a, you know, how rugby was back in the day. Do you know what I mean? And boys had to suddenly adjust to that and go, you're not going to give up. Like, you might not win, but we're going to scrap for that 80 minutes. And if you take us lightly, we'll fill you in.
That's what Floody always said when they went down. Was Floody said, you'd be 60 up and you'd take your foot off and they'd never give up. And then they'd come back and they'd start scoring try, and you're like,
Did you quite enjoy the sort of, I'm not going to use the word lawlessness on it, but certainly you mentioned amateurism. Was that something that sort of appealed?
I did. I wish I was dirtier than I was.
Right.
You know, like I look back and think, there's your headline. Yeah. Right. I played with players that would like just have that natural needle. Yeah. You know, guys that would just, I mean, of course you do, you know, like those guys that would just instinctively Like my local club, Aylesbury, where I'm from in Buckinghamshire, would be like a farmer called Mark Rose. I remember watching as a kid. He had big. He was friends with Gary Pearce of Northampton that era. This ball would go in, and this teenage flanker at the back was all keen, and he just sort of went, yeah. You know, and then carried good on, night. And like Lucky. You know, like you would get away with it. And I loved watching it. I just didn't have that streak in me. I just kind of just enjoyed did it. My job, got that's my head down. Yeah. I know, but maybe yeah, I don't know. It does reveal character, but I've always had an endless fascination with those fellas who just put a shirt on and see it as it's like the ice hockey players where someone's picked just to be the enforcer. Yeah. Like, they're not there for any kind of finesse.
No. Just again, are we talking about up. Mike? Or are you talking about me again? I feel like
it's yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like it's a real undertone to this interview. Yeah. You know. Yeah.
There's a fascinating quote that I've got here, which is that you said, you can't regret things, but I came pretty close. Are those words ring true or not?
A bit. I think I kind of found myself in no man's land in that I probably didn't give rugby the shot it I should have.
Okay.
In terms of making those sacrifices.
Yeah.
Can't have regrets in that.
Yeah, but does that not
regard.
Sit well with you? Because a lot of people who don't make it blame it on other things. Oh, it was the coach, or it wasn't the right time. I didn't come for the right school. It takes a man to go, actually, I probably didn't put the effort in.
Yeah.
Does that haunt you a little bit? Because saying quote like that, you can't regret things, but I came pretty close to it. Because that is something I kind of feel from you as well. There's a little bit of like, fuck, if I maybe had applied myself.
And if I'm being honest with you, I said that at the time.
Yeah.
You know, like I was blaming everyone else. Like, and then now I look back and I was out of condition.
Yeah.
And just because I didn't get picked, I still enjoyed myself, did the training I had to, but I wasn't doing extras.
Right.
I wasn't kind of working at it. And
could you have gone further if you had? Or was that the great unknown?
Probably not.
Really?
I think that makes it easier to swallow.
Yeah.
I think I was probably a good second tier player. My point of reference is the league now, and you just look at the caliber of, you know, especially back rows, and you just think, yeah, okay, I was good, solid enough, got a good time out of it, got even better friends from it, good time to cash out.
Do you keep in touch with characters and friends from along the way?
Yeah, and you know, they're the best bond. You know, I've rang friends, you know, off the back and said, like, my lease has run out of my flat, I need somewhere to live. And they're like, yeah, just move in. That kind of level of friendship. And we're still in touch now. We play poker all the time as a group or catch up when we can. Get older, people's circumstances change, they move around, they have kids, but we, you know, you get together and regress. And I think that's something I'll always kind of appreciate, especially when you go into another world and you meet people who have more conventional friendship circles.
Yes.
When you're like, what do you mean you don't get naked? Especially with,
especially with the BBC and obviously the journey that they're on.
Of course, of course.
All things to all men, to women, to everything that they're trying to be, and very, very, very stoic in their things, I imagine. You suggest, guys, so we're going to go and do this. Oh, no, no, no. We were just going to have one quiet drink in a well-lit building and then we're all going to go home.
Yeah. And I won't go into it, but I have had some close rubs by having to like read the room a bit better. But it's funny, like, I was actually quite nervous going into this because you think, of course I was part of rugby and now you're sort of BBC journalist and it's kind of like trying to retrain that muscle memory. Yeah. Like, no, we can go over that a little bit. But of course...
Have you had to delete
wait, there's a beer.
Exactly.
No, exactly.
No, wait, he's restrained.
We had Alex Donbrandt on the other day who played uni rugby, which is not the same, but I mean, talking of lawlessness, he had his jaw broken twice in really unpleasant incidents. Did you get away with it in vertical? Are you physically all right? You're not sort of lost an eyeball, which just had to be sort of popped back in?
I think my level of size allowed me to get away with things for a bit. I think there was a bit of bullying in that sense.
Yeah.
But I saw things happen to other people, like those shoulder charges you talk of. You know, I remember like a restart going in at uni rugby, my Geordie mate, Carl, just... the quickest I've ever seen him move, just a no arms, this guy. Sort of like car crash style. But I got away with it, really. I have one stinger. That's the only thing I feel now.
God, well done you.
Yeah.
Do you miss the rugby? Do you play at all? You don't put on your boots for old Abingdon?
I play, you know this touch rugby in London?
Yeah.
I play like in the common at the end of my road. I tried to anyway.
Yeah.
And it was just taken far too seriously. You know, they were sort of, they have a real set pattern in how they play.
Oh, okay.
There was like a halftime team talk and they were like, guys, you know, we need to just put it together, you know, think about why we're here. And I sort of stuck my hand out. Like, James, can I just do a patronising run through with you when we explain these moves off nine? Because it's very, very regulated rugby.
Yeah.
And I was like, mate, I live up that road, pretty stressed. I'm just here to kind of do blow something steam, healthy for, you know. And so I actually strangely didn't like it.
Well, I'm not surprised if you come for a fun game because obviously you're not in touch because there's not a lot of space and you're not breaking tackles and sucking people. You have to go forward real quick taps, have to play, otherwise there's no space to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. You want to take part in the walking touch. We did this Vodafone Lions legacy thing and we went to Westbury and they brought walking touch in for all age groups. And then obviously you're walking like those Olympic speed walkers and there's a little bit of cheating if your tins. Definitely 2 feet were off the ground.
No.
But That was great fun. That was stress-free. And because you're not running, you're not out of breath. You can get to take the piss out, but we were getting into the referee, getting into a few people and just
you
playing.
I can operate
and catch because the ball's so slow. It was delightful.
I have a real affinity for that sort of level of the game. I had many happy hours on the touchline at Millmore back in the day and grounds like that with Rotherham.
Where's that? Oh, yes, of course. Yes, of course.
Many years ago. But how on earth do you go from trundling up and down the country, 12 grand a year, selling tackle bags out of a porter cabin, to the role that you've got now? That is a leap.
Yeah, it was... It was a leap where I sort of had a bit of a run up, twisted my ankle a couple of times, and then finally jumped. Yeah. But my chairman at Esher was John Inverdale, still there.
Oh, well, yeah.
Top
he
guy.
He loves it, by the way.
He really does, you know. And if he could help you, he would. And I remember sort of, you know, the end of that season when I was 25, it was 2011. I was like, look, John, I like what you do. I don't know how you get into it. How do I do that? And I ran a blog called adayinmyshoes.com. Doesn't exist anymore. And
well, I'd follow guys.
I follow mates who did different interesting jobs for a day and blog about it. It's like personal training. My mate JC worked for a pest control company, but I got him in trouble because he exchanged services for free curry at a restaurant.
Barter economy.
You know, I thought it was, you know, showed a lot of initiative. So I did that. But then John said, look, if you want to do what I do, do a postgrad or some kind of course in broadcast journalism and then go freelance in local radio. And I did exactly that. You know, went away and had another brilliant transitional year where I put on about 2 stone, went to college in Elephant and Castle, met people that I had never met before. You know, from, you know, some of my best friends today in journalism, you know, one Bengali, one Afghan, one Jordanian, you know, all loose, like completely loose. Yeah. People you don't get in the rugby circle, you know, get up to all sorts.
Yeah. I was questioning his commitment to rugby when you said that you were, you know, it was an amazing year. And I went raving on a Tuesday night, which all things you never did as a rugby player. I was like, well, beg to differ. I often went raving on a Tuesday.
I think it might be a slightly different kind of raving there. There's a mild undertone in that one. I've been raving now as well. I wonder just with the, from your background, because obviously we haven't talked about where you came from, what's a white middle class kind of background? Did you go to uni to start with?
Yeah, I did psychology at Sheffield because that's what my parents and my school wanted me to kind of do. And I felt I didn't have a hard view on it. Did psychology, did it really badly, scraped a 2-2. Can't remember anything from it.
Just because I wonder about kind of the thing you said of the different people you're mixing with demographically now and kind of opening horizon. Obviously, I never went to university. So through rugby and playing all the different countries I played in, yes, I've developed that kind of diversity. But rugby in this country is coming from a different background. It is interesting because some people we've met have gone to medical school. Again, you have a whole different kind of world. Have you had to kind of temper some of the context you had when you were playing rugby and really sort of change your world perspective to kind of get into this job and do things differently?
I did kind of temper initially, just out of nerves. Right. But eventually, when you're like starting out in a brand new career and you're the newbie, you're kind of in sponge mode, aren't you?
Yeah.
It actually, everything else is weighted against you. The weight of me wanting to share the stories of old or behave like I used to were dwarfed by just trying to impress and just not mess it up. You know, there'd be the odd work social where you'd sort of go to the bar. And I remember getting a tray of playing gin face where you get like a tray of shots. Some would be gin, I think half gin, half water.
And you went around,
you got a straight face, the shot, and then the person next to you would go, gin. Never get it right, you go again. And there's been lots of double bluffing
going on.
It's
a great game, why are we?
It's a brilliant game.
It's a very good game.
Brilliant game. So I did that in like one of my really early work socials, and they were like, you're not right. Okay, you're from a slightly different background. But it's got it. I don't feel like I'm parking anything now.
No, but I wondered, you said someone from Afghan, someone from Bengal, did you say? Like
Jordan,
sorry, yeah. Just to kind of like that different level of interaction as well and sort of talk different approaches, different life, sort of almost having your horizons broaden a little bit?
I think so. You know, I've said some, you know, in private, I've said some clumsy things around a dinner table. I remember, we were talking about, we were debating. This is not me saying something clumsy, but like it was around the time of the N-word being used accidentally and we kind of debated it. And I remember sort of sitting there thinking, right, about should you, if you're singing like one of your favourite hip-hop songs, use the N-word or not? And we kind of debated that. And it was just, I remember thinking, it's really good to hear from people around the table who've experienced it their whole lives and been on the other end of it. I remember sort of thinking, actually, this is priceless.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we covered BLM, the Black Lives Matter movement, with work. And having that behind me really allowed me to kind of report it with a bit more confidence, just by understanding the racism that, that your mates experience every day. But then, you know, they don't tell you about it because they always lived through it.
And I had a similar thing with it. You know, I read The Kite Runner, and then I read A Thousand Splendid Sons by Khaled Hosseini about 6-7 months ago, and just about Afghanistan's history and kind of what, you know, the Taliban, what had happened, and also the oppression of women over there and what had, and how it worked out. Because I'd only ever seen it kind of from invasion that we did over there, the fact they'd obviously dealt with Russia, but also how progressive they became and how equal jobs they had and how they were fighting for rights, and then it completely regressed again to separate hospitals for women, no education. I didn't realise that story. And kind of you see, you have this perspective, and kind of because our armed forces are over there, you have this sort of belief. It completely changed my perspective on stuff that I was just kind of blown away by. So I wonder sometimes, so I always try to put ourselves in different cultural situations to hear those different stories, because it's quite, when you see in the echo chamber of life we live in, A, from your parents and your family, and also from the social media we talk about, I think it's always good when you go to work at some places and you sort of think, oh, well, this is what I thought happened. They're like, no, this isn't accurate at all.
Yeah, and you have to kind of surrender that defensiveness.
Yeah.
Where someone in a better place position than you says, James, that's not right.
Yeah.
In a very public setting. And the moment you learn how to do that, you're probably getting somewhere. But I've had some very uncomfortable discussions, but I've been better for it. I think it's important to kind of do that.
Tell me a little bit about your journey then, from Isha, John Inverdell helping you onto or pushing you towards the course that you undertook.
So I went to London College of Communication, did broadcast journalism, and the lecturer, Martin Shaw, who's ex-BBC, said, this isn't a qualification. It doesn't matter what mark you get. It's a training course. You do what we say, use the scripting techniques we teach you, broadcasting, and you'll go get a job. And we were very soon out and about with radio microphones, interviewing people, trying to find politicians, going to council meetings, putting reports together. And then they would have mock news days in the college. Editors would come in, you'd make a connection with them. And then I got my first job at BBC Essex, which is a brilliant news patch if you're starting out. There are murders, missing lions, beach hut scandals. TOWIE was at its peak around then. You know, like in my first week of the job, I was in some of the most brutal murder trials in Basildon.
Wow.
You know, where, you know, the guy was sentenced for 27 years minimum, and he told the judge to F himself and then just stormed out of the dock. You know, you don't see the inside of a Crown Court unless you're involved in some way.
You say that. We've come quite close. But yes, I know what you mean. Not you're for murder. Yeah.
Not
murder.
Not a great court for.
Yeah. But that's, I mean, so that is learning on the job, and in a big way and fast.
Yes, and I think that's a big part of it. You need the freedom to fail. You need to go and make some mistakes. And I just think, you know, in rugby, as a young guy, you're kind of exposed to like so much pressure, or you think it in your head that you can't mess up. The thing about like our broadcasters is that they're based on trust. Without trust, they're nothing. So like, even if you make a slight mistake, I remember my first boss was like, it doesn't matter that you got everything else right. They hear you get the name of the place wrong. They're not listening to the rest of your report or their piece. I mean, I learned early on that actually you got to, you know, get the little things.
In terms of your, I mean, it's probably more relevant as we move along, but you were talking about the Basildon things that kind of sparked it. Are you quite a sensitive person? Because some of the stuff, just reading things you've done since then, which we know a cover on like poaching documentary in Malawi, Arctic Circle with the Marines, going to Lebanon and reporting refugees crisis, obviously in Ukraine where we want to come to. You know, as a journalist, you see a lot of shit that it's pretty horrific, I imagine. Yeah. And transitioning from, you know, rugby on the piss up, yes, you've seen some horrific things in the change rooms, but nothing prepares you for kind of actual human suffering or murders or stuff. I mean, how temperament-wise, how did you deal with that there back then? Was it okay, or were you a bit like after day one going, fuck me, what have I got myself into?
Yeah, there was a bit of that. And then I remember what we call doorstepping, where you knock on the door of a, in this case, it was a mother of a murdered teenager stabbed to death at a party. In Essex. And I remember there were tabloid journalists wandering around, why am I doing this? And you're like, no, there's a public interest in this, the killer's at large, da, da, da. And you know, it's those moments that you kind of wear, and as you get more experienced, sadly you are hardened to bits of it, but also you learn to shield yourself from the trauma. But there are stories like Grenfell, like the refugee crisis in Lebanon, like Ukraine, that just blow that shield to bits, and then you have to kind of recalibrate a bit. and everything else.
Do you ever soften, or is it just understanding how to channel? You just put, you can push them to a backspace, or is it, or do you just learn how to deal with them better and then channel them better to get better questions and pry and I think, get more emotionally attached?
Yeah, well, I think it's a combination. So at college we were taught, and this is going to sound so crass, but if you're interviewing a victim of something, you do the who, what, where, when. So like, what happened to your son? He went to this party, right? And what do you know about it? And you finish with questions like, what was he like? How would you like him to be remembered? Because we'll find those questions the toughest, and the interview may not continue after that point. So you're thinking, what can we get to tell the public about as much as possible before it kind of ends? So you have the technique side of it. I've got better at kind of pushing things to one side, but, you know, there are moments where you just kind of, you know, it is tough. The work are brilliant. The BBC are brilliant in providing the help with that. But you need to equally recognise it. And, you know, I know in the case of Ukraine, you know, it was never more tested. But then you look to more experienced colleagues like Lise Doucette or Jeremy Bowen, and you just saw how they were. And, you know, they still report with empathy and fully aware of their surroundings, but they were clearly more used to it and they were functioning more efficiently.
Have you noticed, or certainly I have, that, you know, when you look at the BBC from back in the day, sort of, you know, everyone had to have a posh accent. There was obviously a certain way of doing things. And obviously the journey that everything in life has gone on to. I think journalists now and broadcasters and presenters are more freely showing their emotions. So, the you know, the stiff upper lip, the British stiff upper lip, you had to be impassive, you have to be empathetic, but you have to deliver it in a way. I certainly in the last sort of couple of years, you are seeing many more journalists breaking down, showing their emotions. Yes, they have to remain impartial, but when something is catastrophically wrong, they are sort of flagging that and saying that actually I'm, is that something actively that you're discouraged to do, or do you feel a bit more freedom to be able to show that emotion? Because you see it at a time where people are breaking down, unable to continue, flagging things, having a personal opinion and sort of sharing that. I mean, is that something you're noticing?
Yeah, I think we're drilled into not be part of the story, and I fundamentally agree with that. You don't want to start saying, well, I think this. Yeah. But there are, you learn, like there are times when to do that, when actually you want to tell who's listening or watching, describe what it is like to be here at this moment in time. And so like there are times in Ukraine where you'd be in city, like towns destroyed, shallow graves everywhere. And I thought at that moment, it was important to get a sense of, as a first timer, and I made a virtue of it, like I've just arrived. We now know what the Russians were doing. It felt justified, but I agree. I think we are in an era now where you reporters are still following the disciplines of good storytelling and putting people at the heart of it on the whole. But they are becoming more storyteller-led. Perhaps that's the digital age we're in now, where the viewer could be doing a million other things, scrolling their phone or whatever. So actually it commands that personality. You know, podcasts have never been more popular. People are striving out, you know, looking to personalities to tell a tale.
They want the longer form of tale, you know, gone are the snapshots. They also want to see how I feel like you want someone impartial because you don't want your political view, for example, to interfere. But also a lot of the time when we're not here in a world where we're struggling for truth and we're struggling for, I think, facts, what's fake news, what's not, what's real, what's not. And if you believe, you know, believe in the deep state and everyone's got an agenda and we're fed stuff to keep us in a herd mentality, you kind of want to look to your journalists and actually see them have a reaction, almost like with a coach in a changing room. I said it before, you know, we lost against Ireland 1 year and the coach didn't come in and no one knew how to feel, because you need a guide on how to feel about this.
Yeah.
I think some things are, but then when we lost the following year, or when Eddie Jones, a couple of years later, he came in and then set the tone. So, yes, you were hard on yourselves, but he said it was okay to feel like the way you were feeling and to move on. And it's a bit like sometimes in the journalism on these on these difficult things, you kind of want to see your reaction to, you know, how just how bad is it? How, you know, how much empathy should I show for this? Is it as bad as it says it is, you know?
But this is where I think there is confusion, because impartial journalists, if you've got a politician on saying, I want to cut taxes, a political journalist will challenge that position. And people will say, well, what about all these cuts to public bodies that desperately need the cash? And people watch that and think, oh,
yeah,
you know, anti whatever the party the politician's from, when actually they're just doing their job. They're playing devil's advocate. So I think that also creates a bit of confusion. But yeah, perhaps people are striving for that.
I worked with dear old Stuart Barnes for many, many years, who divides opinion like no other. And at the end of a game, Gloucester-Leicester, there would be 50% of people saying Barnes is so anti-Gloucester and 50% of people saying he's so anti-Leicester.
Yeah.
Which is extraordinary. How do you end up in the role that you have now? Are you somebody who, well, I suppose to put it differently, do you go looking for the role or do you get given it because of who you are?
Oh, you go looking for it. Right. You know, it's hugely competitive. BBC is a big place. BBC is unfortunately shrinking in recent years. So opportunities are harder to come by. I spent a good few years at Radio 1 Newsbeat serving those kind of, it's the buzzword, but underserved audiences, people that aren't listening to Radio 4 or buying a morning paper or whatever, yeah. People that are actually, you know, working on a building site.
And is that good training? Because you get to the nub of the story and you have to do it as quickly as possible.
Yeah. You know, you write creatively, you put people at the heart of it. You know, if someone's listening to a radio and they hear someone like them talking about how hard it is for them to meet the cost of living and going to food banks, your ears pick up.
Yeah.
You're like, actually, yeah, that's relevant to me, rather than what you talk about. There's a gone by age of top-down storytelling, posh BBC correspondent. Well, you know, trust us, this is going on. Yeah. And I spoke to the minister and they're very sorry, you know. Yeah. But it did put me in good stead. But no, I was applying for loads of jobs and then this one came up and the BBC did a kind of old-fashioned tryout and they put me and a few talented colleagues up for 3 months at a go before interviewing this year and everything else. And I went first. So I sort of landed in mid-January.
Wow. And how does that... I mean, take us through the 3 months, therefore, that you had, because... I mean, that's
five-star hotel.
Yeah. Service. But there won't be many stories in our lifetime which have got the significance of the one that you started telling.
No, and if I'm being honest, Alex, I'm still kind of processing it. You know, like I've told it to death, gone over it, and you know what it's like when you're at the heart of it. You have to kind of take that step away.
You really lived it. You got there in January.
Yeah,
things started escalating mid-Feb. Like
yeah, 2024.
So when you sort of got over there,
did you know where you were going to end up when you went out? As in, did everyone say this is going to happen?
No. So the rationale from bosses was it's quiet.
Right.
Let's blood some new people, get them out there. And I went out there and I knew it was kind of, do you remember? It was Putin had been gathering troops for like 10 months and the language is like, they said this, they're saying that. Ukraine is saying, chill out, it's not a problem. But I landed there. I did a 12-hour day where I was like live on 5 Live, World Service, Radio 4, you know, just talking about a complicated geopolitical story. This is my first foreign posting. So I've got like a very talented producer who's from Kyiv, Anna Chornous, the most patient person in the world. And the Ukrainians are very straight. So I'd come off air and be like, I think that went all right. You know, we need to talk about your answers. My point is, since then, I've been in total sponge mode. And that was in the six, I had 6 weeks of that. And then the unthinkable happened. And maybe I should have been more open to the idea. But when you're, you know, reporting on a government that's saying, we've seen nothing to suggest that Russia is going to invade. When you chat to Ukrainians on the street, who are blunt people, they're like, we're already at war in the east of the country. This is what he does. He's just flexing. You're like, okay. And, you know, it will stay with me how quickly war changes things. Because we often, you know, we get desensitized to it. We see images on the telly of burnt out buildings or tanks or in wars gone by, don't we? And troop movement, and it all feels a bit removed. But we don't really capture that moment when war descends. And the thing about the Ukrainian war is most Western media are embedded with the underdog for the first time that I can remember. So we were there when the much bigger, much more powerful neighbor moved in. And it, you know, Kyiv is an amazing city. Like so many other cities in Europe, and it just changed. It was so striking. In the sense that I walked out onto the balcony around 5 a.m. and this beautiful skyline was all of a sudden, there were claps of thunder in all kinds of directions. Cathedrals that were once lit up as a tourist attraction were dark. Soldiers across the road were burning piles and piles of documents all day. Low-flying jets were going above cloud cover, and it wasn't clear what side they were on. There were images on social media. So the app is Telegram out there of Russian columns just moving in, opening fire, crossing the border, coming in from all angles. There was like, do you remember the Hostomel airfield in Kyiv?
Yes.
And it was like a movie where these just low-flying choppers were just coming in, Russian paratroopers were landing and they were going at it. And if Hostomel had fallen, the Russians could have used it to bring in more troops. And it was happening at a pace that was just impossible to keep pace with. So I was, my coping mechanism was just kind of do my job and not think more than an hour ahead. But then the questions arise, what are the Russians going to do when they get here? You know, are we going to be able to still broadcast? Is there a way out? Oh my God, I haven't texted home. You know, it was just an extraordinary, extraordinary time. And you could, I said it at the time, you could see Kyiv, but you couldn't feel it anymore. Yeah. You know, it was panic.
There was also that first day in, what's the other city? Europe?
Mariupol.
And they'd obviously invaded, but Mariupol, people were still going to work. That kind of attitude of like, actually, oh, it sort of happened, but we're not quite aware of it. I remember, I don't know, you know, there was someone broadcasting in the street saying, look, people are still trying to go to work in the day. Everyone's fine. You see people, some were queuing up to get cash out of the banks. And you're watching it going, is this going on? Because it was weird. Because no one was close enough to the Russians to see them coming in, and everything was sort of third party on social media. So I followed, you know, kind of like armed forces stuff. I followed a few pages and you would see, you know, suddenly helicopters flying, some of them getting shot down. Was that real? Was that from that?
Yeah.
This conflict, you just couldn't really get a handle on it. And the BBC were broadcasting, but it was all kind of guys in Kyiv talking about this is what we think's happened here, this thing. Because some wars, you normally have an overview of what's going on, but it was very much like almost like hand-to-mouth knowledge.
Yeah, it was. And it was, you know, the first, they always say, don't they, the first casualty of war is truth. Mm. And all of a sudden you have both Russia and Ukraine in the West saying different things. Mm. We've taken this. No, they haven't. We've counterattacked. They're on the back foot. No, you know, they're on the back foot. And you would have to take everything together and go, right, it's clear that they're surrounding Mariupol. Like, yeah. That was clear. And you had to sort of really weigh it up. But again, the pace of it.
And then quickly, can you chew through all the information that's flooding in and make a judgment call on what you think is the truth? And how do you ever really know? Because as you say, propaganda is the biggest thing that starts in war.
Yeah.
Because everyone wants to make them feel like they're on top. Is there a certain source line there where it's more trusted that you, through all the networks that you have, or how does that work?
Yeah. I mean, I think it is a team effort. There, in the BBC's case, monitors different news channels and outlets across the world, and they give analysis, but it's a really robust chat where you need to have a good enough relationship with someone to be like, you know, I'm there, someone's shouting in my ear, and I'm like, Anna, you know, can we say this? And if there was any kind of doubt, you just leave it.
The social side of it, because obviously that can be just as misleading, yeah, can't it, in terms of how someone videos something and it makes it look like it's something. How do you get to
be so careful? Well, there's a department, but news organizations have departments called UGC, user generated content. And these people watch all kinds of stuff. You know, it's an extraordinary job where like raw footage comes in, you know, showing the reality of war in many cases, and they have to verify it. So we won't touch it until, you know, if there are multiple reports of an image. So do you remember there was that runaway Russian tank and it ran over a car going into Kyiv? Oh, yeah. There was enough outlets sharing it and putting it around. So we just said, look, BBC hasn't been able to verify this yet. But we, you know, there's an image of this tank rolling in. But then you'd make a broader point and say, look, we know the Russians are north by 20. You'd use it to make, say what you knew.
Have you had to backtrack on it? Have you ever got to a case where you've said something and believed it was true and then you had to say, actually, that wasn't? Because I imagine in a fast-paced situation like that, you have to still make a judgment call.
Yeah.
And obviously, percentage-wise, says it probably is true. And then had to go, actually, by the way, that thing I said 20 minutes ago, it turns out it wasn't right.
Yeah, I mean, I think, if I'm being honest, yes, but it's how you do it.
Oh, fine.
So I think, you know, if you get the language right every time, and I don't, you can sort of say, you just attribute, you say, like, well, they, you know, they are saying this, and we've seen images of them coming in. And then an hour later, you might say, it was thought that was the case.
Fine.
But now, so you're not, you know, because it doesn't matter.
Can I ask you about the difference? And you it's really the pin drop moment when you start talking about the reality of Russian columns coming in, etc. How do you disassociate yourself and your own fears and concerns and stresses from the sort of, I've got to present a 1.5 minute bulletin on the BBC 10 o'clock news type thing? I mean, you think about it and extrapolate it. You know, every night you watch the news, you're watching a very polished, presentable reporter from, you know, crisis situations, and yet you don't often stop to think about what the hell it's taken for that person to get there.
Mm.
And I just wonder how you sort of have to process what you are going through relative to what you're having to present in the role that you have.
Looking back, I didn't process it. In a way, it was easier to cover the outbreak of an all-out war than it was to cover the geopolitical crisis of 6 weeks that I'd done beforehand, where there was, you know, like they're saying this, there's a bit of politics here, da da da. Now it is as simple as, here is what we know, and this is what everyone's going to be caring about looking forward. So that came a crutch, really. Like, just not having time to think about it was actually a saving grace. And, you know, there were colleagues that headed out towards the front line. You know, this was a moving front line of Jeremy Bowen going to Butcher early on. You know, this is like one of the most experienced guys in the game. And he sort of did this briefing, took his team out. And
didn't he get shot up?
That was Stuart Ramsay of Sky.
Stuart Ramsay, sorry, yeah. All right.
You know, but that affected us watching it. It was a reminder of the danger that everyone faced on the front line, you know, and it was moving and there was indiscriminate fire and real risks were being taken. And we'd seen colleagues in other, you know, other news networks who'd lost their lives. So I remember that feeling. They would head out and capture the story. And then it was when the tide of the Russian advance finally ebbed away end of March. We knew what they were doing, you know, and they were, you know, committing war crimes.
There's obviously now, subsequently, so much has been written about what they were doing and how they've done it. And again, if you ask them, they've never done any of it. And obviously, again, I don't read enough of the newspapers or sit to know, but I mean, can you tell us just what it is you saw firsthand and when you realised this was not an ordinary situation?
So it was the second, you're right, there was a kind of moment where you go from the action, where you sort of see the guns going off and the choppers moving in, and then there's a kind of unknown period. And then it was in May that I headed out to some of the places I've been reporting on but unable to get to. And then you come across the human reality. And then we talk about those moments where it gets through your defences and you kind of wear it a bit. And I went to a place called Borodyanka. So these are like small towns outside the capital. So places like Croydon or Luton or wherever, like 40-minute drive out. And I can only really describe it as medieval, where the Russians had tried to destroy it. The Ukrainians heavily defended it, but in the process, the Russians just tried to flatten it with airstrikes, artillery fire, and every building was damaged. The whole faces of apartment blocks had fallen down. There's still laid tables inside on someone's dining room table. Shallow graves at the side of the road next to trenches which the Russians or Ukrainians had used. You know, we see mock trenches in the Imperial War Museum or in Normandy and everything else, but this was real and they were riddled with landmines. We met a police officer called Ivan, mid-20s. He was working late. He signed as a volunteer to help people escape and his home was hit by an airstrike and he lost his wife, his toddler, his parents, his brother. And he's sort of matter-of-fact telling you and you're stepping over the rubble of his home with children's shoes in the middle of it. And that's when it became, I just took it to, you know, a whole new level. And, you know, I don't want to go too morbid, but I think the reality of this, and audiences can't sustain the interest in them, but this is going to carry on. You can't not rule this out happening in other parts of Ukraine. We may never know the truth of what's happened in some parts of this huge country, but this is the reality of this war. And it's happening closer to home than you think.
Are they doing what they say? Are they just indiscriminately executing civilians, executing everyone?
There's clear evidence of that. Yeah. So they've been, you know, there's evidence of civilians being executed as they moved in. They were trying to target people in the national defence, people they saw as the enemy. But the shelling of residential areas is a war crime. You're deliberately targeting civilians. And there's clear evidence of that. Again, the Kremlin denies it and sticks to their line of blaming Ukraine.
Obviously, the Ukraine, off the back of that, are then saying, you know, tens of thousands of potential war crimes. Is it your duty then help prove those correct or prove them incorrect? In a weird way, do you have to stay completely impartial and you just have to take each one on face value and you can either validate one or you can dismiss one? Or
in an ideal world, we're verifying it. And we've seen pieces on like the reality of where grain's being stolen. Fergal Keane did a piece on executed on the outskirts of Kiev using open source content, you know, what satellite imagery, CCTV footage of men being led away. And it's a single testimony, but when you combine it with this other footage, you can verify the allegations that are being made by Ukraine. I was at a war crimes trial. And yeah, we report it impartially. You hear what the court was told. You reflect the testimony of the guy in the dock, a young Russian soldier. We also reflect that the Russians are staging their own trials in unrecognized territories in the east of Ukraine. But there is a greater game here. Yes, there's a fighting on the battleground, but there's also prisoner exchanges. And this is also a separate game in itself as the Russians look to try and convert people to their thinking.
Do you find it frustrating that you work for an organisation that essentially is trying to be impartial and to tell a story, and you're seeing it firsthand? Yes, you know, the more you go out to those regions and there is anecdotal stuff, and as you said, there's open source content, but you're seeing it, you understand it. There's no smoke without fire. You see what you've seen. And then you have someone like a state-run media that the people in the country genuinely don't know what's going on, or for the most part, they either don't want to know, they don't look into it, or they don't want to know. We see it in sort of North Korea. You'd think in most of these places, civilized places, it wouldn't happen. Does that frustration, that naivety, that some, you know, even the Russians, the ones that are kind of converted in Ukraine, think they're doing something noble? Does that shock? Does that anger you? Because for me, I'd just lose the plot, because you're like, I don't understand how you think that this is okay, and that, you know, the narrative about Nazis. I know they do. I know. Again, I've seen some of the new stuff that, you know, a lot of Eastern Bloc countries are not great with race, and they're not great with that. And you see, there's a lot of black people in Ukraine who have been oppressed. You see it, and there are news bits coming out of it. And I know they do have a neo-Nazi element to some of the stuff, but they're not a Nazi country or hiding Nazis. Does it stress you out, the amount of bullshit, and you're all trying to do a good job, and actually it probably isn't reaching the people that need to know about it?
It is depressing. You know, and you're right. It's on the Nazi thing. Like, this was the Azov Brigade. They were once a group of volunteers, ties to the far right. And you're right. Ukraine is a country that is tainted with extremism, as is the UK.
Yeah.
The Azov Brigade were then merged into the National Guard, legitimized, and as Kiev's concerned, they got no more links to the far right. That's all the Kremlin needs to build a kind of basis for some kind of attack. Still a sizable minority who do want to be taken. There are friends of mine in Kyiv who have parents in the east under artillery fire. The Ukrainian army is saying, come with us. They watch Russian state TV. They choose to.
That goes back to the Second World War, to Stalin, and when he put a lot of Russians into basically what became Middle Europe at the time, wasn't it?
It's the stage after that. So it's their, you know, it's their lived experience of the Soviet Union, where, say, in this Donbass region, which we talk about so much, it was an industrial heartland, you know, where there were plentiful jobs. It served a real function in the wider USSR. And then in the collapse in the early 90s, Putin has written about, he regrets the collapse of the Soviet Union. He sees it as one of the biggest disasters. And these people share that view. They're like, oh, this was once a beating heart. There were coal mines or steelworks or whatever. And now there aren't any. And now we're being told by this liberal government that they want to join the European Union and NATO. Well, I miss the times of old. There's a nostalgia.
Mm.
Identity is complicated, right? But one part of it is generational.
If you remember good times, or you think you remember what good times were, then that's how it should be run.
But of also course, indoctrination when it was the Soviet Union, in terms of the belief, the power, they could do no wrong. They were, you know, they challenged America. They challenged everyone. They were, you know, a nuclear power. They had that whole raft of identity before it fell. And for some, I mean, you see it in every movie that's ever been. You know, there's always a rogue Russian general wanting to hark back to this. You just never think the president is going to be, you know. I haven't read a little bit about it. It almost seems like a
given away when he made it impossible for ever to get voted out.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, exactly. When he turned,
it's consolidated.
Yeah, so I mean, yeah. Do you remember we had to have that break to become prime minister while he let the other bloke in, and then they fiddled with the constitution so he could come back in and do it? And then the fact that everyone gets, it is like a plot for a movie, just any enemies liquidated, anyone challenges. I mean, I don't know if you've had this, but again, anecdotally, I talked to a couple of people that have done stuff in regards to stories against Russia, that they have had phishing emails into their email boxes to click links, hacking stuff, slightly concerned, had to go onto phones. Other people didn't. I remember there was some, I was talking to actually Ross Kemper, it's always dangerous, at an event, and he was talking about a story that a journalist done, and that they basically wanted to release his documentary, but no one would touch it. Because I don't know who it was or what it was on, but there was a real concern that actually, if you're going to go, it was on Netflix or something about Putin, and it was like, hold on, this is a little bit hot to handle because they are taking reprisals. Was that bullshit?
No, I can't think of any good editor that would turn their back on a you know, like the bar is that high now. You want to drop jaws and you want to offer real insight.
Fine.
You put it in the right context.
Yeah.
You need to hear all views.
Yeah.
Shying away is
no,
not
but
really...
like using a different phone or something set up a different email and stuff like that.
Do you worry about your own situation?
I did at the start, and they said there's a department called Information Security or InfoSec. And I had this Zoom call with some very stressed people from InfoSec back in January when the Russians were looking a bit tasty. And they were like, so when did you last change your password? I was like, don't know. And they were like, okay, do you have this app where you know those apps that change your PIN numbers or like forge rocks, you know? And they're like, you don't. Okay. Can I just take remote control of your laptop for a couple of hours? And, you know, and they just tightened everything.
Do you have two-step authentication on?
Yeah.
No. They're literally like, oh my God, does your password have any numbers or unique symbols in? No.
James123.
Any capital letters?
Yeah. No. Yeah. I'm not stupid, it's my day of birth.
Yeah, but you're not worried about that, because there was some anecdotal stuff about that kind of, that, you know, they're not scared of hacking stuff, or so you read in the papers or seeing.
Before this invasion, the Russians, it was widely accepted, were more advanced in cyber warfare than the West.
Yeah.
You know, they put huge resources into it. And the night before the invasion, they did this unprecedented cyber attack on like government websites in Ukraine. It was called a denial of service attack, where they flood it with fake traffic to cripple the website. And I was asking my mate, he's a cybersecurity reporter, Joe Tidy. I was like, so how do I describe that? And he went, oh, they it's to embarrass and possibly distract them from something more serious. And of course, we now know what, you know, that more serious thing was. But I worry about many things, and rightly or wrongly, I don't worry too much. Maybe I should.
And then, on that hacking, and then you get Anonymous come out and they say they're going to create war on Russia. Do they actually do that?
It's not clear. I mean, you get a lot of vigilantes online that try and like rock the boat.
Someone trying to get some, not fame, but
possibly.
But I think if they do, because obviously they take a lot of pride in that, and it is such a murky world, there'll be definitely some diehard people trying to, who will get a beer in their bonnet to try to do
that. No doubt, but you know, as far as we're concerned, like, unless there's an actual event to report on, you need to take it with a pinch of salt.
What have you made of like Zelensky and obviously how he's handled? Can you imagine Boris Johnson being in this position? Trying to do that.
Well, they love Boris over there, don't they?
They love him.
Yeah.
You know,
really? Talking about him because a Ukrainian ambassador.
He needs a job.
It could be available. I mean, the affection is simple, but it's nevertheless a deep affection. You know, when they find out you're from the UK, they shout Boris Johnson at you, because all Ukrainians care about from January onwards, when I was there, was who's helping us? Because it's only going to be us that's going to fight this. That's clear. So who's helping us, and with what, and for how long? And that was all they cared about. People were so frustrated with Germany with their initial hesitancy to reverse on their policy of only sending humanitarian support. But they love the US. They love the UK for making early promises. But of course, their views of Boris Johnson aren't shaped by domestic issues.
No.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, it was interesting.
Did you see that select committee the other day when the day he got shafted, and he's sitting there, and basically we've given away so much of our own air defences that we can't make them in Belfast or in Northern Ireland. We can't make them fast enough. So we've actually put ourselves into a deficit. And he was like, we'll sort it out. And it's like, well, Boris, you know, we're taking one of the most powerful people in the world. Should have saved some missiles, Chief. You know what I'm saying?
When do you get back out?
Monday.
Wow.
Yeah. So,
God, thank you for coming to speak to us. You're not meant to be sort of.
I love the pod.
Things. Oh, good on you.
Yeah, yeah.
We're an hour's time out from.
I find that such a strange thought that he'll be lying in a bed and there'll be bombs dropping outside and he's got our fucking useless tones in his ears.
Yeah. I love it. I just get lost in it.
Do you have to prepare yourself for that, or do you just literally pack a toothbrush and say, cool, I'll see you in 3 months' time?
Well, in my case, I didn't have time to prepare for it, but like the first time around. But no, I've got my personal protection equipment there. Kevlar vest doesn't quite fit, it's more like a crop top. And the guy in the rental place was like, biggest we got.
Don't shoot the gut, lads. Don't shoot the gut. Shoot the chest, not the dog.
Yeah, exactly. It might absorb the bullet, but and otherwise, you pack normally. You know, it's more simple than you think, but the operation is takes a lot of planning. I've got I've got a good boss and people around me that I really need to lean on. The challenge now is to keep it on the agenda and find new ways or new voices to bring it, and that's our job.
That's a ridiculous question, but are there moments of levity, or is it just 3 months of real intense storytelling? There is nothing but war. I don't want that to be a ridiculous question, but sometimes there are sort of scenarios where you find yourself like, wow.
Yeah, I think there are definitely moments, you know, where you sort of step back and go, like, I can't quite believe still this is happening. You know, in my case, it's when you look at a map and you sort of think, right, so they control all of this. And like the Russian playbook is occupy. They're unable to take over cities, so they just surround it and bombard it. They're not very good at urban warfare, but they've got the military hardware and men to surround and just cut people off. People die, homes are destroyed, then they move in. Then they stage sham referendums to be recognised as independent with Russia, puppet local politician, pump people with propaganda and Russian state TV. And it's that where that gets me, where you see sort of Big Brother-esque lorries moving through with messaging and people walking past just rubble after everything they've gone through. And those
and you
moments.
You see it working.
It's hard to measure because access is so difficult in the occupied territories, in like Kherson in the south, Crimea, it always has been, Mariupol. And then in the Donbass, you've got the most intense fighting. Like no independent Western media has been able to get embedded with the Russians and see that side, or let alone go to the places which have now been occupied. And given the lack of evidence at the moment that Ukraine can push the Russians out, you know, from what or take back what's been taken, that doesn't look likely, even with the added help anytime soon. So it may be some time before we find out, at the very least, find out what's happened.
Is the death toll, I mean, the last time I saw something around Russians, they'd lost 25,000 troop men and something like that. Is there any indication that they are having that level of, we won't mention his name, but we actually spoke to a former Special Forces guy and they were saying, look, actually Russia looks great, the equipment looks great, but you pull the door, it falls off, and they haven't appeared to learn from many of the conflicts that we have in terms of supply lines, looking after yourself, not overstretching it. They just do on a volume basis. They've got a lot of people and actually he doesn't give a fuck and he'll chew through thousands of people just to get to an objective. Is that the kind of vibe you're getting over there in terms of they are getting massive losses? Because according to them, one small Dachshund's got an injured leg and that's about the end of it.
Yeah. On the issue of death tolls, it's really hard to say. Even by Ukraine's own admission, they distort the figures too.
Right.
But I think we can safely say it's tens of thousands. Ukraine, 100 of its own soldiers die every day. Jeez. And you meet people in Kyiv who know people on the front line. There are funerals happening all the time. You know, the signs of war are there. You meet prisoners of war who've been exchanged who are lying there with fractured pelvises, for example, from tank fire. Their bodies are basically in metal frames. But Russia did get found out in the early stage of this war. They, you know, Putin wanted to topple Zelensky. Zelensky stayed. That's why he's as popular as he was. He had an offer from the US to get out. And one of the most popular quotes I can remember, it was almost Arnie-esque. He was like, I need ammunition, not a ride.
Fantastic, that.
Which, you know.
Legendary.
So like, war does, you look at, you know, there's resemblances of Churchill there, and, you know, in terms of stepping up to the plate. And I think he has done that. But Putin wanted him gone.
But he's trying to get him liquidated. You know, they said that, I remember the early days, they said that they Chechen hit squad or something had come after him and they'd been liquidated. That was the term. But I remember like when the BBC or someone's reporting on that is a line from a movie or a book. Mm. You don't hear it. When they're quoted as saying, Zelensky's people are quoted as saying, an attempt was made on his life. They were liquidated. And then they cut to another screen. You're like, sorry, what do you mean liquidated?
Because there ain't no questions.
You just shot everyone, did you? And they're like, it's just mental that this is going on.
It's quite, and like, I think the key word there is film.
Yeah.
You know, like Zelensky's production values in some of the messaging he's put out.
Looks,
you know,
great,
it's just, you know, like Moody's walking down like Krestatyk, one of the main streets in Kyiv, with anti-tank defences everywhere. And he, you know, this guy is a successful actor and
he's
TV personality.
Well.
He's a comedian.
He's a comedian.
You know, he played a normal civilian who ended up as president of Ukraine in a drama series called Servant of the People. And guess what his political party's called? So he's living, you know, the overlap. It's playing out. But then, like, I conversed with Putin. Do you remember that address he gave on the night of the invasion? Where alongside everything that was happening in Kyiv, he did that address at his desk and he looked down the camera and he said, I have now started a special military operation. Any attempt to resist will be met with consequences of which we have never been seen before. I mean, it's villain stuff.
Yeah.
And there are moments where I have to, like, this is...
Like in a volcano. It's like if he was talking to you on his desk in a volcano, when he's going to put a laser on the moon, you wouldn't... Yeah.
Is Putin ill? That's the rumour, isn't it?
That is the rumour. I think there is a question of legacy, which he, I think, is thinking about. He is 70. He's been in the job for more than 22 years.
Is he 70?
Yeah.
He looks all right for 70, shouldn't he?
Yeah. Probably good routine.
No, but you're not right, because I would didn't know 70. No. I never would have thought he's 70.
Roughly 70, but I think he's 70. Right. But, you know, and as discussed, he's consolidated his position. it's clear he resents the fall of the Soviet Union. Mm. It's clear he resents the very existence of Ukraine as a country. He sees it as part of Russia. He sees people of the same blood. It's clear he wants to stick two fingers up to the West and reorganize the world as we know it. And all of these things are kind of, you know, just playing out. But
is it a ridiculous question to ask what comes next?
No, because, you know, it's a well-asked question and we know audiences want it answered. The point is we don't know.
Right.
I think there are a number of scenarios and some are more likely than others. I think a change of heart is less likely.
So you think Russia will just keep going?
Yes.
Is that they will keep going with Putin, or if Putin goes, does it change?
That's not clear. It doesn't look like anything would change should Putin go.
Really?
A colleague, Gabriel Gatehouse, who knows a lot about Russia, described it quite well. He said, like, Putin is not a person. You have to imagine him as like an institution.
Right.
He's this big tree trunk and all the branches connected to him, all these people get rich off him. So if the institution goes, the thought is that he will be replaced with someone else to serve that function. The intense fighting we're seeing, certainly from the Russian side, they're making gains of like a few miles here and there. They're taking some towns, but these aren't big gains in the big scale of Ukraine, but it's symbolic. It means Putin can go, see? And yeah, never mind about toppling the Nazis which run it. My new aim of taking the Eastern Donbass region, we've done it. You know, it's something he can present as a win. He's in control of this huge land corridor. He's taken more than half of Ukraine's coastline. He's got a naval blockade that is suffocating the country. And there are no signs that that's going to be retaken. So does he then enter into a peace negotiation? Well, what do you think Ukraine's saying? No way. Like, because where does it stop? We can't concede territory. I mean, that's politically unfathomable, doing that to the Russians and seeing rewarded in any way. So then what?
Those sanctions not having an effect on those rich people, they're not really, is that...
It is biting, but yeah. I think it's going to take longer. You know, that's going to take time, and time in a war is not your friend. You know, like people, a lot of people are dying. There's going to be a lot more fighting. I think a peace deal will eventually come, or this increased military help may well change the tide. But I can't see, even with more sophisticated missiles and motivated men that the Ukrainians have, it's hard to see how that is really going to change the tide once the Russians have moved in and consolidated. And don't forget, the Russians have got their own border behind them and they've learned painful lessons too in this war. So all I can say with any confidence is that we are in it for the long haul, and the very question of Ukraine's future and the wider world will remain in the balance.
Are you concerned about what you're going to go back into? Because obviously, you know, from where you left, how long have you been out of it now?
Oh, I've been out 4 weeks.
4 weeks. Okay. I mean, but even in 4 weeks in times of war, when going back there again, you know, is it going to, do you have to steady yourself? Have you managed to switch off and when you go back in? At least you've got a good team.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a very crass comparison. But in regards to sort of rugby, you know, you play a game, you get injured, you watch two sessions of training, like, fuck me, I can't do this anymore. This is awful. Mm. And then imagine in the fast paced landscape and what the atrocities are going on. Do you know what you're going to walk back into? Do you have to sort of stay up with it, even though you're supposed to be away from it?
I feel more confident that I do, and I've got a firmer grasp of it. But you're right. You can make that parallel. You know, you do have to be match fit, I think.
Yeah.
And if I'm being honest, everything caught up with me in the second spell, and I just found myself totally drained, because these things do catch up with you. And you speak to experienced war reporters, they're like, stay on top of it, you know, because it might not get you straight away, but you do need time to process and allow. So I've seen a fair bit already. The story is now very much in the East and South, so I'll be keen to kind of bear witness and see it, and, you know, safely as possible tell the story and reflect the kind of human cost to it. It'd be good to explore the pro-Russian question, those voices we haven't really heard yet. You know, it's less popular to have pro-Russian views, but it's nevertheless part of the story. Yeah, but it's due balance. That's the key word, isn't it? It's due balance. But, you know,
also to hear what the hell that they think's going on. Do you mean even just to sit and ask and go, you know, like, yeah. I always like it when you sort of get a North Korean person breaks from the north to the south and they're just utterly shocked that it's completely different. And you sort of, you know, they've heard about stuff, but they didn't realize that actually Kim Jong-un is not, or whichever one it is not this.
Kim Jong-un.
Kim Jong-un is the amazing person.
But it's years and years and years and years and years and years and years of indoctrination, isn't it? It's that's, don't ever see it from the other side.
No.
Never allowed to.
Yeah, and I'd love to see that. You know, would you
I'd be interested to see
in a non-confrontational way. Yeah. You not treat them like a politician, but be like, you know, how do you explain this? Yeah. Or, you know, where do you think your friend's children are? You know, that you haven't heard from their sons in a long time. You know, it's, but you look at Putin in decades gone by, you know, he tries to hide any sign of weakness and he silences critics. And, you know, people are unable to both express or...
I just wanted to know, how are you protected? Because obviously you said, is the Geneva Convention about allowing press? Like, what is the stuff around not shooting the press?
So we get...
It's friends.
Yeah, so it's yeah. But we have guys in our news networks called high-risk advisors. Almost all of them are ex-forces. So they'll come in and do like the most ninja risk assessment ever. And they'll have these iPads where they've got the front line and who's moving where. And they're just so impressive. I mean, you know what, like, guys in the services are like, yeah, you know, yeah. Like, I remember the early days, I was like, oh, there's a lot on my mind right now and I don't really know what's going on. And, you know, one of the guys was like, they're not in it for any kind of glory, yeah, yeah. But they're just so like, we know they're moving here. Our time to get through is here. Come here. You know, and you speak to guys on the front line and they're saying, come here, come closer to me. They're just coordinating. And the art of good war reporting, I think, is kind of, you can reflect what's going on. It's the art of getting out of somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, whilst it's going on, you know, the audience get it. They can stitch certain things together. But these guys are just amazing. They really enable you. It's a tough relationship between them and editor, with the editor saying, we need to...
You can't
do that, you know. And there were moments where it's extraordinarily dangerous.
God, so you are the piece in the middle, really, between the editor saying, get in, I want the story, and the special forces saying, get out, you're not going to make it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I don't want to lose anyone on my watch.
Yeah, yeah. But it's an important discussion. But we are nothing without them, you know, and it's the risks are very real. And what impresses me is how they're just never off duty, you know, like, yeah, they'll come and have a beer with you maybe in the evening or whatever else, but they're like...
Are they armed and they're there to protect you at all times?
No, no. That would be more dangerous.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. So we are unarmed. They are, you know, they're there to advise and assess. Right. And all the high-risk teams from different, like CNN or ITV or wherever, they all talk to each other. You know, it's actually in your best interest to share information.
It's not
information.
Like scooping them, going, oh, I think they're over there, lads. And they get blown up. And you're like,
yeah, exactly. It's great to go through that channel right there.
Those aren't mines, they're mushrooms. Yeah. See you later.
We've just done it. But it's a fascinating whole other operation. Okay. And, you know, I can't big them up enough because, you know, you need them. And I don't know the first thing about military tactics or... You know, the conventions of a front line. And sadly, as we've seen, journalists have been, you know.
I'm always interested with that because how much branding do you have to have press? Because if you imagine an adrenaline situation where you can't think and you're fighting for your life, Ukrainians are fighting for life, Russians are fighting for their lives, everyone's fighting, and you're doing a piece in the middle of it, how quickly can your mind register, oh, fuck me, I'm not supposed to shoot them, they're wearing a press thing? Because that is how dangerous it could be. Or, you know, a wayward thing, oh, there's movement over there, we can see it on a drone. We'll just blow them up, and it suddenly turns out to be the press. I mean, do you get how close can you actually get, or is it?
It's extremely difficult. So in my case, I was in Kyiv as it was surrounded. I wasn't on the front line.
Fine, okay.
I sort of went in after and saw the brutality and everything else. But there were, you know, there were people who got in trouble. Thousands of people signed up to the territorial defence. Showed ID. Zelensky even tweeted like, "Anyone wants a gun, we'll get it." So he showed ID, and they're like, "Here's your AK." So early on, they were very nervous, untrained people.
Dad's army style people,
and like one of the guys just, you know, playing with his film, his lens, you know, just trying to like change it. And what does that look like in the back of a car? And someone untrained, you know, it raised a lot of concern. And then there are also issues of getting access. The army wary of journalists trying to get close. There were, if checkpoints appeared in news reports, those very checkpoints would be targeted.
Because you know, like I said, Dad's Army, there was that thing where I remember watching a documentary on the UK where they sort of had these guys. And there was a farmer walking across a field with a bucket of potatoes, and they got shot and killed because they said it was a bucket for grenades because some old duffer thought it was the thing. And I imagine that tenfold with the technology, you know, in the dark.
It was a really scary time.
Yeah,
but like I don't say this lightly. And people said it before. They were like, "Yeah, I'll fight." And you know, we met people in rugby who sort of fancied themselves as hard, like. The men and women, and we now know they meant it. And they are so calm. They're like, "Yeah, I'll fight." Wave goodbye to my daughter and picked up my sniper rifle and I've gone. And, you know, thousands are being mobilized every day. Hundreds are dying, but they are fighting because it is, you know, as they see it, their very existence.
Fucking hell. Jesus.
does make a bit of a difference from Moseley away, but Potence Bees at home, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Imagine the field looks like one of the bits of rubble on it, though. Similar sort of setup, like a road, road in Ukraine. I think I played on that when I was training in Acton.
Yeah. In some craters, just scrummaging.
What a remarkable story. Have you sort of stopped at any point to think, shit, that's been a journey?
Maybe Christmas. I don't know. I did. That was the best advice I got. Yeah, was to keep a diary. Someone hopefully write a book one day and sort of. But you read the diary back. The language there and sort of people often talk about it's the people around you that find it hard. But it was people are like, "Are you okay? Are you alive? Just please tell me." And the one text I sent to my girlfriend was like, "Explosions have started. There's a plan. Love you."
That's all
I could get out.
Right.
And you sort of think, it's when I got back that I realized
I was on
what
the receiving end of that. I'd want to know a little bit more.
More context. So where is it? Fireworks? But it was.
If I disappear for an hour, my wife, she would have commandeered a drone.
She was on the explosions.
You think the Russians are going to hack him? My wife would give him a run for the money. Every time I laugh too much, the little drone would warning pops. Are you having too much fun?
Coming.
Yeah, coming.
Shit. I mean, extraordinary. There are so many other questions we'd love to go into. Will you come and see us again when you get back?
I'd love to. It's a real privilege to be here.
It's
thanks for having
really
me.
Good to have you on. And just what an amazing story. We love amazing stories. And from Isha and Graham Dorr at Plymouth Albion through to the front line and Zelensky.
You should get Dorsey on. Absolutely.
It's armed him well.
But, that's very true.
His time at Rotherham. Yeah. I mean, there's
head-butting tractors.
Bulletproof.
Be very careful. Go well.
Thank you.
I hope you're well looked after out there. But keep up the amazing work, James. Thank you very, very much indeed. That has been absolutely fascinating. We've got a couple of bits just to tell our listeners and viewers about because rugby's leading mental health charity, which is Looseheads, are on a bit of a mission. I'm sure most of you know the good work they're doing to place a mental health lead, i.e. a loosehead, at every rugby club in the world. And they have just launched a brand new 24/7 text line. And if you need some help, please do check them out. We speak about this often on the pod, but members at all Loosehead partner clubs will have access to the 24/7 service that is run by volunteers at Shout. To access the service, users simply need to text the word rugby to 85258. That is the word rugby to 85258. And they'll get a reply within minutes for a confidential service that's completely free and totally anonymous. An amazing service that hopefully will be of help to some of you out there. We do, as we've said already, make a real point of talking about mental health on GBNR because we know it isn't always easy. It isn't always easy to find people to talk to, and it's certainly not always easy to open up to friends, family, or teammates. And this service means that people now have access to a support line at the times they need it most. They've got almost 500 clubs already signed up. So if you or your club isn't part of the Looseheads family and you want to sign up, please do head over to their website for more information. And the number, once again, 85258. Simply text the word rugby. What a remarkable initiative. And well done to all at Looseheads for pulling that together. Brilliant. Really lovely to chat. Thank you very much.
Thanks, fellas.
Keep in touch.
We'll do.
Fantastic. We have been The Good, The Bad and The Rugby. We will see you again very soon. The show is produced by Sam the Man. The Good, The Bad and The Rugby is a Folding Pocket production.
Thank you so much for listening to The Good, The Bad and The Rugby. It can't have been easy.